and then a climate chamber trial where we'll actually measure core temperature when women are exposed to different heat and humidity. So their team ran a study published in Sports Medicine a couple of years ago, a small study, but looking at exercise on a stationary bike in pregnancy with non-pregnant control women, and finds that actually core temperature did not differ in how it increased between those who were pregnant and those who were not. And we need to understand whether this is one of the mechanisms that leads to these adverse outcomes, because it's only if we understand the physiology a little bit better that we'll be able to offer interventions to support pregnant women to keep cool, particularly in different parts of the world like low and middle income countries.
Well, we must know something physiologically about why pregnant women are more at risk than other groups. What do we know?
I think what the hypothesis is that your ability to cool down is compromised when you're pregnant. So we know that you may heat up a little bit more when you're pregnant compared to when you're not, because you have two people and the fetus generates its own temperature about half a degree higher than the mother's core temperature. We also know that normally you cool down by sweating, and that you actually have a reduced kind of surface area so that to body mass. And that means that your ability to cool down by sweating might be compromised in pregnancy. However, the body is very clever. So actually, pregnancy already does some physiological changes to compromise for the fact that you might be less able to cool. And so some of the more detailed nuances about what happens really have been hypothesized and not studied in humans. So we have a lot of data, for example, from cattle. So we know that for cows, there is a risk of extra heat. There's a risk to heat waves. This can result in the same sort of adverse pregnancy outcomes. We understand a little bit more about the physiology there than we do for pregnant women. And that's partly because pregnant women are often excluded from studies because they are, you know, thought to be a vulnerable population. So we do know that, yet your ability to cool down and how you deal with heat is compromised in pregnancy, but that actually there are some physical compromises that are made. For example, increased blood volume and fluid volume that actually try and sort of mitigate some of those changes. And what we really need to understand is what happens so that we can actually work out interventions.
Adrian, you also specialize in stillbirths. In fact, you are the chief investigator for the Stillbirth Center of Research Excellence. How big is the problem of stillbirths globally, and does extreme heat increase that risk?
So around the world globally, there are about 2 million stillbirths every year. So that's death of a baby before birth. And when we look across the world, the numbers are calculated from 28 weeks of pregnancy and beyond, because that's where the data is collected and stronger. So actually, you know, this is really a sort of an underestimate, because in many high-income settings, we would count these deaths from about 20 or 22 weeks of pregnancy. So if it's at least 2 million stillbirths globally every year, that equates to one baby dying before birth every 16 seconds on a global scale. The risk of heat and stillbirth is thought to be about 1.1 to 1.2, so 10 to 20% higher in areas where people are exposed to extreme heat. Now, that 10 to 20% sounds quite small, but obviously if you apply it to those numbers on a global scale in a world that's heating up, those things are actually going to affect many more people than anticipated.
What do we know about how rising heat levels and heat waves can affect later childhood health and maybe even lifetime health outcomes?
Look, that's a really good question. I guess we know that there are other areas in pregnancy that appear to be affected by extreme heat, like diabetes and preeclampsia, and both of those things have long-term impacts on the child, as does, obviously, preterm birth or being born of low birth weight. So if there is an effect on an unborn baby from a complication to the mother, those complications can have lifelong effects in terms of cardiac health, cardiometabolic health, potentially later life risk of diabetes or obesity for the child. So those conditions, those non-communicable disease conditions, are all increasing globally, and much of that has been thought to do with rises in obesity globally. But many of those conditions are also associated with heat exposure, so they may sort of have an additive effect on lifelong health. We know that, for example, for children, so infants, toddlers, also less able to cool themselves down and may not have the kind of normal voluntary urges that we would have as adults to, you know, drink more water or access somewhere colder. So certainly in extreme heat, younger children are more at risk of heat stress, and that, of course, is important at that life stage.
Part of your work reminds me of a talk I had with Dr. Francisca Pereira of Columbia. Their team strapped backpacks on women in Harlem, New York, to measure air pollution coming into their lungs during pregnancy, and they found actual changes to DNA, I think, in the womb due to smog. So moving to Australia and Canada and around the world, now we have heavy wildfire smoke as well. Have you or others studied the effects of wildfire smoke on babies in the womb and pregnant women?
So I haven't done that work myself, but there's quite a lot of work looking at outdoor and indoor air pollution, adverse pregnancy outcome, for example, stillbirth. And there are trials in other countries looking at cleaner cook stoves and stillbirth reduction. And actually a team that have run a study called the Polly Borton Trial are actually engaged in our Wellcome Trust project. So that's Camille Rains-Greeno here at the University of Sydney with the ICDDRB in Bangladesh. They ran a large trial looking at reducing household air pollution. So that's certainly one area that we know is important. And there's also been population-based studies, I think in the US, Canada and Australia, looking at bushfire or wildfire smoke and adverse pregnancy outcomes. There is a risk there. And clearly, with higher temperatures, the risk of those bush or wildfires will also increase. So in our planned cohort study, we will also be measuring air pollution as well as ambient temperature, as well as individual measures of temperature exposure.
So during hot, humid weather, what are the danger signs to watch for in pregnant women?
So if people are feeling hot, feeling faint, that's a perception that they would have, and they should try and seek shade, drink more water, try and be somewhere where there is wind. So we should in general be trying to, you know, be somewhere where we're sort of, I guess, cooling the air less, but moving the air more helps a lot. So simple solutions in low-income settings, like a cool rolled-up towel in front of a fan on the back of the neck, would cool people down. We know that if heart rate goes up, that can be a sign that the body is not dealing with higher temperatures. But obviously, not everyone is walking around checking their heart rate. So from a perception point of view, if people are feeling faint or feeling too hot or feeling dizzy or nauseous, then that might be a sign of heat stress. And they should try and make sure that they are well hydrated and can seek somewhere cool if possible. Obviously, in many parts of the world, you know, we have really very effective ways to keep the air cool, as in air conditioning. But for many women, particularly in low and middle income settings, you know, they might be out working in the field, carrying water, doing really marked physical exertion right up until when they have the baby. It's obviously much harder in that setting to try and keep cool, but yeah, hydration, light clothing, less exertion if possible, and somewhere where the air is moving is important for anybody, but particularly for pregnant women.
What do you want governments in developed countries to do to lead the way to help protect the next generation during these climate extremes?
Yeah, well, I think investment into maternal, newborn and child health is very important. As I mentioned earlier, pregnant women are often excluded from these kind of overarching policy areas, from clinical trials that are thought to potentially be risky. And I think unless we actually can have policy that globally applies to pregnant women as well as other adults, we will not be able to protect this population. So I guess it would be a call to ensure that pregnant women are included in policy, that interventions are targeted and tested for pregnant women so that we know they're effective, and that they're really thought about in terms of workplace and country strategies in terms of protection, because I think this is not a problem that is going away, and it's a population where we really need to think about protection and prevention and coping strategies.
From the University of Sydney, Australia, we've been speaking with Professor and Medical Doctor Adrian Gordon. You can find links to the news and science we talked about in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Adrian, thank you for helping us with these important matters.
No problem. Pleasure to talk.
We just have time for a sample from the Climate Gen podcast with UK filmmaker Nick Breeze. Nick interviews leading scientists for his members and then posts them on YouTube. Find out more at www.gen.cc.
In this Climate Gen episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Jack O'Connor at the UN University's Institute for Environment and Human Security. Jack is the author of the Interconnected Disaster Risks Report that is looking at tipping points impacting human security and the Earth system. The report is available for download via the notes, as well as a link to the main website with detailed insights into a number of risk tipping points.
Jack, it's good to meet you. Thank you very much for taking the time today. With regard to this new report on risk tipping points, can you start by specifically defining what we mean by risk tipping points?
Well, with risk tipping points, what we mean is these are points in systems that we use every day. So human systems, our systems we rely on for food, water, but also things in the environment. The first key thing is that these risk tipping points can apply across many different systems. And what we see in these systems that we use is that their risk in these systems is increasing towards a point where the systems will no longer be able to function in the way that we rely on them to. And after their function changes drastically, now new risks can emerge. And that's what we really try to focus on.
Can you use one of the risk tipping points that you use? Groundwater was an example. Can you talk us through how the groundwater risk tipping point can extend beyond its sort of regional setting and become more widespread?
Absolutely. So yeah, the groundwater tipping point example, if we're talking about interconnectivity, there's a few different ways that we approach it. One is that we look into a tipping point to dig back into what we call root causes. And these root causes usually manifest in our behaviors and our values as people. And then stemming from that, we design systems in certain ways, often with certain weaknesses and vulnerabilities that contribute. If we think about the groundwater issue, which is that we're bringing up water from underground to irrigate our crops, this has worked well for a while and helped us to cope, especially in arid areas, to irrigate during droughts, for example. But now we're reaching this point where they're starting to run dry. And some of the underlying drivers and causes for this, things like risk intensifying land use. So despite the fact that we can see the problem coming, we're still pushing the accelerator to extract further and get what we can now, rather than make a more sustainable system. And this kind of behavior also underlies other tipping points in our report. For example, there's one on accelerating extinctions. There are a few underlying drivers, many of which are well known, but underlying these drivers, we also see a desire to extract resources as much as we can without little future planning and without considering the impact of our actions. So these underlying root causes can interconnect cases. But also when we talk about tipping points, once tipping points pass these critical thresholds, now they can increase risk in other types of systems. So for groundwater is an interesting case because it's something we don't see. It's underground. People don't think about it much, but science tells us that underground in these, we call them aquifers, these freshwater reservoirs, there are actually rich, diverse ecosystems also. And so once these things are getting drained, we are also unaware of the impact that it's going to have on these underwater ecosystems, but it can likely lead to less biodiversity, which cascades into further extinctions.
And in the report, or sort of with the report, you do highlight some of the groundwater issues in India. And I've interviewed hydrologists in Italy who are saying that there's a huge sort of deficit if you look at the groundwater like a bank account. Do you think that as we move forward, that we're accelerating the risk for things like agriculture? Is that another way that these systemic sort of interconnections can filter back out and reach people who may think they're immune from these?
We try to focus on groundwater for food and irrigation. Yes, as you say, we do look at India, Italy. I think that another one of the ways that the risk increases is that we rely on groundwater to shield us in times of drought, for example. But when we run out of groundwater, we see that people are now trying to shift back to a rain-fed agriculture. And this is a problem considering the changing climate. Rainfall is no longer as reliable as it used to be. So we're sort of jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire now. And when we need to come and rely on weather patterns to save us, it's just a riskier way to do things. If we see groundwater, if we see ecosystems, and we see some of the other systems in the report as our safety net, as our tools to cope with risk, and as we pass these tipping points, we're sort of cutting these cords and the net is getting weaker.
And to stick with the groundwater, we're talking about agriculture, which food systems, and if a large one of these fails, you said it's not just the local economy, but it's also that community needs to get food from somewhere else. And that puts pressure on other supplies. And these are the ripple effects that we're talking about, aren't we? There's less food to go around globally. These cause shocks to the system.
Yes, absolutely. I think that we're starting to, and I say we, you know, people around the world are starting to understand this more and more. I think the war in Ukraine, for example, people started to understand that we rely on food that is not grown where we are. And that means that something that happens on the other side of the world is a massive problem for us. And while today we might not be directly involved, we don't know about tomorrow. And so we need to really reduce risk in these kind of systems. I mean, we saw for groundwater, this is not a theoretical point. Wells have run dry already in many places like Saudi Arabia. And once they lose this ability, now they're buying up agricultural land overseas and actually buying up agricultural land in places that are getting more stressed, like the American Midwest. So the people there are running out of water, not just due to their own food and economic needs, but also from other places.
Another item which I thought was really interesting was uninsurable future. And obviously, I mean, this can only be relevant in parts of the world that are insurable, which is generally places like Europe, I suppose, and wealthier parts of the world like the US, Europe, etc. Can you talk a little bit about how this impacts us?
To start off with, yes, on the surface, it does have to do mainly with the people that can afford insurance. There is a big push to try and protect as many people around the world as possible with insurance, and it is still challenging to achieve this in, for example, the Global South, and this will become more challenging as we go along. This issue of people no longer being able to access insurance because the damages being inflicted by different hazards and the risk rising due to climate change, now people are losing what they had already. But this problem does then, once this point is passed and an area becomes uninsurable, there are cascading impacts that affect everybody. So, for example, not just homes, but also businesses. If they're unable to get insurance now, it's hard for them to buy or access properties, and they may start to move away from a certain area. And so for the people that don't have the resources to move, you sort of have these areas of high risk with people trapped there without coverage. This also affects government that now has to step in and support more, which draws resources away from other services. So even though on the surface uninsurability protects the wealthier people, in the end it will affect everybody.
And we already see insurance companies pulling out of places like California, and I think AXA have warned that there are thresholds to what they see as insurable. I think as temperatures go up, they just have, that's an uninsurable world, etc. This has a huge, you mentioned a cascade potential. This really for countries where people who consider themselves probably quite well off or secure could suddenly see themselves flip into a different status. Do you think that this could be quite a serious impact as we go forward now? I mean, in terms of how we perceive life in the wealthier parts of the world?
I think so. There's an argument to be made that if you have insurance, you may encounter what we call moral hazards. So you're insured and you feel like you can be risky because you have a safety net, where what we're trying to do is get people collectively to step back from taking risky choices. And the people that are waking up suddenly in California and different places of the States to find that they're not covered anymore, it comes as a big shock. And now they realize, I think, more the risk that they're in. So I think the idea is that insurance is one part of a toolbox that can help us to manage risk, but we need to wake up to the fact that even if we have insurance, the risk is still rising, and not just for insured, but everybody. And that's what needs to be taken care of, rather than thinking, okay, I have insurance, I'm good, and then wait till the day it rescinds. And you're suddenly in a very risky situation.
And do you think there's a connection here to loss and damage is basically results of impacts of climate change, and is in the context of climate vulnerable nations who are generally global south and much poorer. But if you suddenly find yourself uninsurable, then you are, your whole life is changed. And it helps us think through some of the real impacts of what we're facing now, is that it's not just those people over there. It's something we've got to consider on a much broader scale, and maybe helping those people over there will help us understand these issues much more widely.
100%. I would support what you just said there, Nick. I think that in order to reduce risk for ourselves, it's important to reduce risk for all. Insurers, actually, the risk has raised so much. This problem of uninsurability has been coming for a while. And one of the steps they took a few decades ago was to get insurance for insurance companies. So when it's getting too expensive, now you get this thing called reinsurance. And reinsurance covers a much wider area, and that's how they're able to absorb these big costs. But it also means that a disaster that happens far away, if it's covered by the same reinsurer as you, can raise your premiums, even if nothing has happened in your locality. For this reason, and there are various others, I think this idea of collectively reducing risk, having it matter to you what happens to someone somewhere else, helps to reduce your risk for sure.
Yeah, and it just comes back to all of these tipping points, is that it's an interconnected system. Just very quickly, there's one called space debris, and I didn't really know what that meant. Can you just give a very quick overview of what space debris is in terms of a tipping point risk?
Absolutely. The space debris case, it seems to sit a little bit outside of the others because nobody thinks about space too much. But the the risk there heading towards a tipping point has to do with the fact that we're launching satellites, and from now and into the near future, we're looking at escalating that quite drastically. But we haven't yet well regulated, especially the low Earth orbit, which is where a lot of our satellites end up. We don't have good plans to bring down these satellites. And there have been a few collisions and explosions in the past also that means that the orbit is filling up with debris or space junk. Meanwhile, we're sending up more and more satellites, and there is theorized to be a density where it gets so crowded that if there is a collision, the debris from that will then start a chain reaction that hits another until the satellite infrastructure is basically no longer able to be used by us. And we use these satellites, among other things, to monitor weather patterns and anticipate and give early warning for disasters. So once we lose those eyes in the sky, our risk of in many all systems goes up. So we wanted to illustrate that and press for the need to transform how we think about using our space around the planet.
How much resource is being put into studying this at the moment, or even coming up with a strategy for tackling it?
I think that there is a lot of resource and strategy. For example, people are looking into ways to remove junk from orbit. It takes a lot of resource, obviously, to do that. In our report, we look especially into solutions and what are we doing, what can we do? And we classify them into solutions that will delay us getting to the tipping point and transform in a way where we can avoid it. And a lot of the solutions that we see, not just in space, but in a lot of the tipping points, is that we found good technological ways to delay getting there, like maneuvering satellites around to dodge junk. But in order to really address it and avoid the tipping point, the challenge is space, like a lot of what we call the global commons, where it's not owned by anyone in particular. There are political reasons, security reasons why there's a lot of distrust between countries, and what we need is to find a way to overcome these for a unified solution among countries to regulate and make decisions on being more sustainable.
This really brings us towards what the part of the report that is a framework for confronting these challenges. Can you talk a little bit about the framework? I mean, the three words that stick out are avoid, adapt, delay. How do you encapsulate all this?
The framework deals with two binary things. So there's avoid, adapt, and there's delay and transform. The avoid and adapt relates to the fact that as much as we want to do what we can to avoid tipping points, some of these are unavoidable. So, for example, we look at mountain glaciers. Some of these we are going to lose. It seems difficult to avoid that happening. So when we think about solutions, yes, we want to avoid, but it could also be time to start learning how to adapt. And then the delay and transform, as I say, the delay of things that we're doing to try to give us more time before things fail. So in terms of glaciers, there are a lot of interesting solutions, like laying blankets on the glaciers to try and get them to melt slower and this kind of thing, which helps. But in the end, the people that depend on these glaciers for their water, and that water is going to disappear in some cases, need to start transforming the way that they use water, start transforming the way that they value water, in order to make sure that when the tipping point comes and the water slows down to disappear, that they're ready and they don't face the worst impacts. And it's not just for the mountain communities, but this kind of idea about changing how we value water and other things applies to all of us. It's difficult to change your value when you don't see the immediate impact. So if you turn your tap on and the water comes out, and if we can start to shift how we see things to being precious, to not being throwaway, to not being endless, we'll reduce our risk in a lot of these tipping points.
That was a sample of Nick Breeze speaking with Dr. Jack O'Connor at the UN's University Institute for Environment and Human Security. Jack is the author of the Interconnected Disaster Risk Report on tipping points, human security, and the Earth system. My thanks to Nick Breeze for sharing his work. You can find more of his great interviews at www.gen.cc. That's GENN.cc. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.